Hello, everyone, and welcome to The Heart of Sports with Jason Springer and Jeff Cohen, powered by ELEC 825. We are thrilled to join you on WWDB 860 AM and 97.5 HD2, part of the Beasley Media Group, ready to help you move into the weekend, talking about all the news in the world of sports. Normally, I'd throw it to Jeff, and I'd say, hey, did you watch Thursday Night Football? But we're bringing you a best of this week. We're going to let you enjoy some of our favorite interviews that we've had over the last couple months. Then we'll be back live with you for a new show right again next week. All right, Jeff, it's almost Father's Day this weekend. What goes better with Father's Day than baseball? So let's bring on journalist and author Dan Schlossberg, who has a book out that we can tell him about, too, that you can get for Father's Day. Dan, thanks for coming back on with us.
Great to be back on with you, Jason and Jeff.
You know, we enjoyed our conversation about your Hank Aaron book so much last time and have since gone on to talk additional Negro League conversation. I'm actually curious as we start, because the Negro League numbers being integrated happened after our interview. So I'm curious your thoughts on, given everything you talked about how much Hank Aaron struggled and didn't get recognition, what are your thoughts on baseball finally integrating the stats from the Negro Leagues?
It's a good choice of words, integrated. I'm very, very well put, actually. But my thoughts are that baseball made a mistake, a big mistake. And the reason is because you cannot take the stats from any leagues where the records were either lost or poorly covered. Newspapers that covered the Negro Leagues, like the Chicago Defender, went out of business. You know, the records of the Negro Leagues were just lost, basically. And it's hard to compare. Let's put it this way. Babe Ruth never faced a great black pitchers, and Jackie Robinson never faced a great white pitchers. So it's just impossible to do it. However, if you look up the record, look up baseballreference.com, look up Josh Gibson's record. He never hit more than 20 home runs in a season, according to the integrated statistics. Well, that can't be. Thanks to Baseball Reference, they did a 162-game average that showed that he averaged 45 home runs a year. How could he average 45 home runs a year and never hit more than 20 in a season? As Yogi Berra would say, something's not kosher in the state of Denmark.
So talk to us about that. If integration is questionable in your mind with the numbers, is the recognition important of what these players did, given the recognition that Hank did not get while he was playing in the big leagues?
The recognition is critically important, and that's why we have the Baseball Hall of Fame. Many of the best stars of the Negro Leagues are in the Baseball Hall of Fame. But getting back to this issue of MLB using the records, SABRE, Society for American Baseball Research, just came out with a report that said there were a whole bunch of leagues, black leagues, after 1948, which was MLB's deadline, that should have qualified as major leagues. In fact, all of Hank Aaron's home runs in the Negro Leagues, he had five, didn't count because they came out to 1948. Well, how do you draw this arbitrary timeline? I just think they made a mistake trying to do this. I know what they're trying to do, but you cannot research something that's not there. You cannot justify something that's not there. It was lost. It's a shame. It's too bad. But that's why we have the Hall of Fame.
Well, that does seem a shame. It's a shame that, see, I think that there is more value in integrating these numbers and including them than not. But I understand what you're saying, and it actually might be doing a disservice to some of the players in the Negro Leagues because the statistics were not kept as well. That their statistics are actually better than what is going to be recorded by integrating them because, as you say, the statistics weren't kept the way that they should have been.
Satchel Paige is a great case in point. He claimed that he pitched 2,500 games and 100 no-hitters. If you look up his integrated record, there's nothing that says that. So he obviously pitched more no-hitters than Nolan Ryan, but how many were in exhibition games or in pickup games? Sometimes these Negro League guys would play a triple-header, maybe one scheduled game and two pickup games against a factory team. So that's just the way it was. They would do anything to make a living, and that's why they played all these exhibition games. But Satchel Paige, 100 no-hitters? I don't know. That's not what the record says.
Well, unfortunately, we can't ask Hank Aaron what he would have thought of what Major League Baseball did. You knew him well enough that maybe you can tell us what you think based on what you knew about Hank Aaron, how he would feel about this.
He was greatly discriminated against. In fact, it happened early and late in his career. Early in his career, when he was in the minor leagues, the Braves sent him down to Jacksonville in the South Atlantic League, also called the Sally League. It was an all-white league. He and Felix Mantilla and one other black player went down to integrate this league. They put up with a lot of abuse everywhere they went. In fact, I once asked Hank, I said, was there any city that you enjoyed going to, or were they all bad? He said they were all bad. Every city in the league, including his home Jacksonville City. So that was just the way it was, unfortunately, in 1953. But he spoke with his bat. He was the MVP in that league, most valuable player in that league. The next year, he was in the major leagues. So Hank Aaron went through a lot. And then later in his career, as he approached Babe Ruth's record, there are a lot of bigots out there who didn't want to see a black man go after a white man's hallowed record. And they threatened his family. They threatened Aaron's life. That's why his kids were not present when he hit number 715. You see his wife there. You see his parents there. His kids were with their biological mother in Jacksonville watching on television because of the threats against Aaron's life. In fact, Aaron told Dusty Baker and Ralph Garr, two young black outfielders on the Braves at that time, not to sit next to him on the bench in case somebody shoots him during the game.
It's that.
This is what he had to live with.
It's that story, which we talked about last time, that has stuck with me watching baseball now and watching how close all the players are in the dugout and the celebrations they have, and just how he had the opposite. He encouraged people to stay away from him for their own safety, let alone his. I just can't imagine what it was like to go to work every day telling people, don't come near me for you.
And on the road, he had to stay in separate accommodations from the team, had to eat in separate restaurants. Some nights he just slept at the Braves ballpark when they were home. And the reason was he got all this hate mail. In 1973 alone, he got 930,000 pieces of mail. Not all of it was hate mail by any means, but a lot of it was. Dusty Baker said he would just throw it on the floor in the clubhouse so the other black players could pick it up and read it. This is what Hank Aaron was up against. Babe Ruth never had something like that when he was going for 714.
So we don't have that today facing baseball near as much, but we do have other threats to players and other problems that baseball's facing. And I had sent Jeff a story earlier about baseball players that are being threatened over gambling now. And you're somebody who has watched this game. You are a historian. You've covered it for decades now. We saw five players suspended last week for gambling. I mean, they basically threw away their career over losing a couple $100s. Can you talk about the impact that you're seeing as somebody who's watched this game that gambling is having on it now? We had the Pete Rose time. We've had other players. You don't gamble on games. But now they tell you don't gamble on games while it's sponsored by FanDuel or ESPN Bet. So can you talk about gambling in baseball?
Jason, I'm glad you brought that question up because very few people have talked about it. Years ago, Willie Mays and Mickey Mantle were greeters at an Atlantic City casino. They were suspended from baseball by Bowie Kuhn because of their association with gambling. That was tame compared to what's going on today, where you read on all the websites what the odds are, what FanDuel says, there's so many different ones. And if baseball is in bed with gambling, which it is to raise more revenue to cover payroll, how do you discipline the players not to bet on baseball? They are allowed to bet on other sports. The first thing you see in the clubhouse, when you walk in the clubhouse, the first thing you see is a sign that says gambling on baseball is not permitted. Actually, what that means is gambling on your own team is not permitted. And what did Pete Rose do? He was a manager of the Cincinnati Reds. His team, during his five-year tenure, finished second every time. It probably should have finished first once or twice. I'm willing to bet, and I don't know this for a fact, I'm willing to bet he bet against his own team, knowing he can make the Reds lose. A manager can't make a team win, but he can make a team lose. And if money is that dear to him and that important to him, why would he not do that? And he never really admitted exactly what he did. He never really apologized for what he did. Had he done that, he would have been in the Baseball Hall of Fame years ago.
Well, not only that, he wrote, I believe, two books, one saying he didn't and one saying he did. So he finds ways to capitalize no matter what the truth is.
He wanted to sell more books.
Yeah. And to your point, just so people understand, you don't have to bet against your team for it to be bad. Like for There are people that say, well, as long as you bet on your own team, what's the big deal? Well, no, if you only bet on certain games to win, but then don't bet on other games, it could have the same impact because people then know, wait a second. Why is the manager or the player betting on their team to win only sometimes, but not other times? So when people say that, it always baffles me because there are ways that you can gamble without necessarily showing your hand. And to me, the concern is with baseball, as Jason started talking about, is you've now opened this can of worms. All sports have now opened this can of worms. I don't think anybody actually anticipated some of the things that are now coming out, which isn't just that the players are gambling, but players and coaches and members of teams are being harassed and threatened because their statistic, they're not getting a hit here or there. They're not doing this because these people are gambling. Is there a way to stop it?
I would hope so. Personally speaking, I mean, I watch MLB Network a lot. What I resent probably the most about MLB Network is watching all the odds that are posted for every single game. I'm not a gambler. I don't care about the odds. I care about the winning and losing pitcher, who hit home runs, what the standings are, who's going for MVP, Rookie of the Year, Cy Young Award. That I care about. The gambling, I could care less about it. If MLB Network would get rid of it, that would be great. However, FanDuel and others are sponsors of MLB Network. They can't get rid of it. They're in bed with gambling. It's too bad.
Well, they've got two problems there in terms of their network and their television stuff. They're funded more by gambling in terms of the advertising side of the revenue. And then on their distribution side of the revenue, they've got a lot of these networks that are in bankruptcy. So they've got markets where they can't even see the games because either the local service is in bankruptcy or they're fighting with a cable company. So baseball's got a squeeze going on from both sides. They can talk about the product on the field and we can get to the changes and the rules and stuff. But off the field, they're trying to grow their base. Jeff and I talk about this all the time because I gambled in a prior life and quit. Jeff does not like gambling. And so I have a little more of a palate for it in what I'm watching. He has none. But I think that these leagues, rather than pushing the personalities of the players that they have, they're pushing to get them hooked on the excitement of having some money on the game. And so then you get into, they have to watch it on TV because they've got money on the game, as opposed to they can just follow their players. So I think you kind of have like one or the other kind of coming first year that are converging a little bit.
Now, one thing we should mention is Shohei Ohtani. This is a bigger deal than baseball is letting on. He is the golden child of Major League Baseball. Nothing can harm him, according to commissioner's office. However, this gambling scandal, how can anybody borrow or steal even $16 million from a close friend the way his interpreter is charged with doing? Something is not right with that. My gut tells me, and I can't substantiate this, what if Shohei paid off his interpreter to take the fall?
Well, just a thought. Jeff kept asking that on the show. How did the accountant not know? How did the lawyers not know? It's one thing to say you logged into your friend's account and stole his information. It's another thing to have all the professionals that he pays for all the money that he makes not realize that there's money being siphoned out and missing.
Yeah, very true. And by the way, when I talk about Hank Aaron, I always say he's first in clean home runs, meaning no mm-hmm. cheating, no steroids, right. Also no gambling. He was one of the most honest, had more integrity. Just an incredible player, humble man, an introverted man. There's no way that he would have put up with gambling. If he had seen that in the Braves clubhouse, it would have been exposed instantly.
Jeff, why don't you go ahead?
So I just want to talk about Shohei Ohtani for another minute. It is in just the larger context. Well, first of all, in the smaller context, it makes no sense. Some of the things that have come out, there are governors in place when large sums of money are to be taken out of an account. Having your interpreter call and say, hey, by the way, wire a couple million dollars here or there is not something that normally happens. The fact that this went away so quickly because the interpreter is going to jail, does that mean now that this investigation is actually closed, or does it mean that the investigation is still going on under the current to make sure that nothing comes out later on. Because to me, the worst thing that baseball or anybody can ever do is cover something up. The best thing to do is just come forward and come clean. If they sweep this under the rug and somebody like you then uncovers it and writes a story on it, it is a much worse situation, especially when it's a gambling issue in baseball.
I totally agree. MLB, when they suspended these five other guys, including one guy for life, they announced that Shohei is cleared and that investigation is closed. Maybe that's what the commissioner's office says, but mm-hmm. the feds have not said that. I believe their investigation is ongoing. We'll see. We have not heard the end of this. It's too big of a deal. $16 million? That's too big of a deal.
Well, and it's larger than just Shohei and his friend. It's the bookie. And the bookie is what has been the catalyst to take him and other people down. So it's a question of who else tells tales about who else is involved around this. You had, I think it was another one of Shohei's teammates who got suspended for gambling as well.
David Fletcher was in AAA.
Yeah. So I did want to ask, you know, you're somebody who watches a lot of baseball. Jeff and I have debated rules forever. He loved when they did the shift. I hate the ghost runner.
No. I didn't love the shift. I love banning the shift. There's a difference.
Sorry. I should clarify. He loved banning the shift. He has complained about the shift for years. I hate the ghost runner. I agree with both of you.
You're both right.
We both kind of enjoy
that. Never happens, by the way. We're not both right.
And normally one of us is definitely wrong. Oftentimes me. Where are you on the new rules? We kind of like the shorter game, might be a little bit faster than some people would prefer, but how do you feel about the changes that baseball has made so far?
Some are good and some are awful. Let's talk about what I call the Manfred Mann being the automatic runner. You know who Manfred Mann is, right? I'm sure you do.
Blinded by the light.
There you go. This is the most idiotic, disgraceful, embarrassing, abominable rule in baseball history. Without question, Rob Manfred should be shown the door right now. And if it's such a great rule, Rob, how come you don't use it in the postseason? Because it sucks.
By the way, Jason, that's what it looks like not to sit on the fence.
That may be the best quote we've gotten on the show in all of our years doing. And you're right. I mean, it just drives me absolutely crazy. All of a sudden, like, you could have nothing going on in the base path all game. And you get to the ninth inning and it's like, okay, if you don't do it here in the 10th inning, you're going to have base runner out there. Good luck. And it's like, just move him over, get him in.
One sec. Close my window because my landscaper decided this was a great time to do the yard.
It always works out that way.
That's what drives me nuts, though. It's so arbitrary. Like, hey, let's try to make the game faster by throwing a runner out there. Like, if you want to speed up the game and have a pitch clock and things like that, you're working within the pace of play of the game. It just seems so random that they decided that was something that would be a good rule.
And it's about to get worse. Because do you know how they're going to, if the All-Star game happens to go into extra innings, they're not using the ghost runner. They're going to have a home run derby to decide the All-Star game.
Yeah, but that's the All-Star game. I mean, look, at this point,
it should have integrity. The All-Star game needs integrity.
I am on your side. This is Jason will call this a get off my lawn issue. But the fact is the All-Star game is an exhibition. So, yes, it would be great if we could all go back to our child. No, it would be great if we could all go back to our childhood and have the All-Star game where it mattered, where people busted their butts and it meant something to win it just out of pride. Then that would be great. We're not going back to that for the All-Star game. We should, but we're not.
The All-Star game has so many things wrong with it. I don't even know where to begin. Number one, it should be a day game on the weekend, as it is in every other sport.
Thank you.
Well, Jason agrees with that.
A night game on Tuesday night.
People
on the East Coast, they watch half the game, they have to go to bed.
How are you going to grow your audience?
Some of us go to bed before it starts.
How are you going to grow
your audience? Besides that, the fans are too stupid to vote. They're too stupid to vote. When I was a kid and I grew up, the players, coaches, and managers voted. It was one man, one vote. You could not vote for teammates. That was an objective, fair election. This one is like an election in Honduras. You can vote five times in one day, every day.
It's absurd. That I don't understand. Why do you get to vote multiple times? Like, well, like nobody's ever explained to me what exactly the logic is behind that.
In fairness,
you spend more time on your computer involved in baseball. That's the logic.
Yeah, they want you to engage more. But in fairness, I used to get a card at the ballpark and I would check off Rico Bronya and every other Philly that didn't deserve to be on the All-Star team because they were a Philly and I thought it would be there. So I don't know that it was ever a perfect process, but Adam Silver.
Wait, hold on. We need to stop this right now because, Jason, the fact that you voted for Rico Bronya for the All-Star game is making Dan's points about fans being too stupid to vote.
Exactly. I should not have been able to vote, but I was. And so I would just vote for every Philly. Not that they deserve to be there, but they were my guys. Well, and that's what I think a lot of people do.
Every team is promoting vote for your favorites for the All-Star game. Right. Yes. I'm a Braves fan. I just got an email yesterday. It said, send these guys to Texas. And it showed the 8 Braves starters. And you know, I put a little comment on that. You know what I said? Send these guys to Gwinnett.
Well, I mean, and look, I can.
For people that don't know, that's their AAA team.
So you're a Braves fan.
Wrong way they're playing.
You're a Braves fan. And I mean, for the Phillies here, the last 2 years, Phillies have been 10 plus games back at this time. It's a reversal this year in terms of the injuries the Braves had and how they have played recently. What is going on with that franchise? Is that a larger problem than the injuries, or is it just the injury bug with them?
One of my issues in baseball in general is long-term contracts. Everybody used to have a one-year contract. That was a much better way to do it. And on top of that, nobody knew what the other guy was making. If you work in a factory, do you want to know what the guy down the hall is making? And then you go to the boss and say, well, he's making so much, I'm worth more. That's ridiculous. And that's what baseball has done by exposing everybody's salary. It's made it horrible for everybody in baseball.
Operating engineers are the men and women that move mountains. And the Engineers Labor Employer Cooperative, ELEC, puts them to work. They create opportunities for the men, women, and union signatory contractors of Local 825, repaving our roads, keeping our homes bright and warm, and even building our favorite team stadium. We understand infrastructure. That's why ELEC and Local 825 are ready to get to work.
Let's talk to the man that Tony Dungy referred to as the greatest assistant football coach in NFL history, Coach Tom Moore, who's got a new book out this week with Rick Stroud called The Player's Coach, From Bradshaw to Manning to Brady and Beyond. Coach, got Jason and Jeff here. Congratulations on the book.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be on your show.
Talk to us about this. You're somebody who does this because you love it and it's fun, but what's it like to see 60 years of coaching experience, 45 in the NFL, put together in a book?
Well, I wanted to chronicle my experience and life and the game of football and the National Football League has allowed me to live a dream. And I wanted to share that with people. I wanted to share a lot of lessons learned with other young coaches. Maybe they'll read the book. I know I read Bill Cowher's book, and so many things were in that book. I wish he'd written it 30 years ago because I learned so much, but didn't have that many years to apply it. So maybe some of the things that I've said in the book can help younger coaches. And then I also wanted to really express my gratitude and thanks to all the players, coaches, owners, and fans that I've had an opportunity to work with and for.
You know, Coach, you've coached so many teams, so many great teams, so many great players. The thing I actually wanted to ask you about first that I took away from your book was your early coaching days, coaching in the Army. What was it like for you to coach in the Army while you were serving your country?
It was great. I went to Korea and was assigned a platoon up in the 8th Cav, and I was talking to the colonel at the officers club, and he asked me how I liked it, and I said, it's okay, I like it. But I said, you know, I love coaching. Well, it just so happened that the existing division sports officer and football coach was rotating back to the stage, so he knew the general, so he got me an interview. And you know, you're 8,000 miles away from the United States, and the troops, they need different types of entertainment. So we had four teams in Korea, two in Okinawa, and two in Japan. And we played each other. And it was great entertainment. It was a great sporting for the troops. And we played every Sunday, just like the pros. And they'd bring the troops in and big trucks, and that was your entertainment. And trust me, the generals wanted to win every bit as bad as the owners do. And then because of Coach Nair, I went to Fort Benning, Georgia when I came back. And service football in those days, the United States was big. And the team at Fort Benning, actually, that was personnel-wise, that was the best team that I coached. I got into professional football.
What was the thing that you took away from that experience?
The first thing I learned in the Army, and the colonel told me very explicitly as an officer, that you can delegate authority but not responsibility. And he made it very clear, you're responsible. You're responsible for these people. You're responsible for what they do, and you're responsible to put on a good show. So that element of responsibility as opposed to authority has always stuck with me, and stuck with me even as I became a coordinator in college and in the NFL. You are responsible.
Seems like that was good advice for what you ended up getting. That seems like a compliment from Chuck Noll when you were in Pittsburgh to that of, he taught you the philosophy to make the best better. Talk about how that became the foundation for what you did, coupled with what you learned during your time in the Army.
Well, that was Chuck's philosophy of making the best better. And his application of doing that was teaching, and teaching fundamentals and teaching techniques so players could play fast. He was more into teaching than he wanted teachers, not presenters, as coaches. And that's what makes him better. And that also was Chuck's form of motivation. He used to tell the players the first day of training camp, I'm here to teach you, not motivate you. And motivation to him was very simple. If you teach someone how to do something that they didn't know how to do, and then they're asked to do it and they have success, that motivates them. So that was what he wanted you to do, teach them how to do things so they have success.
You know, Coach, you've coached some of the greatest quarterbacks in this game, some of the smartest quarterbacks in this game. I'm going to put you on the spot, not ask you who's your favorite, because I guarantee you, you're not giving us an answer.
Right. You're correct on that one.
If you had a choice, you could have one or the other, but you couldn't have both. Would you want a great mind of the game or a great physical athlete?
Well, I think you'd like a combination of the of both. I think you got to have the physical prowess to play the game. The mental aspect of the game, all three quarterbacks that we're talking about were very smart, were able to call their own plays. I know Terry did at Pittsburgh, and we got to the point where Manning was very, very special. He could do things. He could read things at the line of scrimmage. And the thing that you're looking for in a quarterback is three things. Number one, the quarterback that can remember and recall what he's seen. And then once you recall it, then you have to process what you're looking at. And then once you process it, then you got to execute. And you get about 1.8 seconds to do that. And all three of these guys were special at doing that. And I've told people, Peyton was special, and I was very involved with him. If we didn't take advantage of what he was able to do at the line of scrimmage by checking and calling his own plays, they'd have thrown me in jail for malpractice.
It takes me longer than 1.8 seconds to figure out what I want to ask you yet. I just can't imagine processing all those things that quickly. The book talks about your role in the evolution of football, but you kind of talk about, as much as things have changed, it's still about blocking and tackling. Talk about how the game has changed, but also stayed the same through what you've seen.
Well, one thing that the game has changed, obviously, is the throwing game. That has evolved, and I think that really started to evolve in 1978 when they changed the chuck rule at the line of scrimmage, where you couldn't jam the receivers after 5 yards. And that in part was due to Mel Blount, because he was such a force at the line of scrimmage. That opened up the game from a passing standpoint. And then I think the colleges have perpetuated that because, you know, in colleges, number one, you don't see any fullbacks anymore. You don't see the great blocking tight ends. A lot of your tight ends are actually big wide receivers, and they throw the ball more. I mean, I was just watching games this past weekend, and you see college quarterbacks throwing the ball for 300, 350 yards. Well, that has evolved over the years, and then that transfers up into the pro ranks. So you see a bit more of a passing game.
Coach, you've been doing this for a long time. What motivates you to still stay involved in the game?
Well, I love it. It's my life. It's the one thing that I truly enjoy doing. And I tell people, I'm 85 years old. And you don't know until you're 85 years old how great a feeling it is to have a job and a place to go to work.
You know, the book in the preview says, in an era of systems, analytics, and X's and O's, Moore maintains a refreshing focus on the Jimmies and Joes. You are always quick to remind people that it's about the players. I know this book is your book, and so you're getting credit, but talk to us about what it's like to go through the game giving credit to the players as opposed to seeking it yourself.
Well, it is a player's game. And a lot of my philosophy was cemented with Chuck Knoll's philosophy, because it was very similar. And once he believed the same things, why it just confirmed what I always thought. And it's a player's game. And I remember Chuck was telling me when he was at Pittsburgh and having those great years and great success, he said, "Tom, don't ever get into financial competition with your players." And if you ever remember, Chuck never took any commercials, no endorsements, no speaking engagements. He says, "Tom, give everything to the players. It's a player's game for the fans and for the owners. And we're kind of caretakers to try to help them get into their life's work and have success." And to me, that's the fun of coaching too. When you see guys that you've coached have the great success, the Tony Dungy's, the Lynn Swans, the John Stallworths, the Peyton Manning, these guys have excelled in football, but after football, they've gone on and had great careers. That's very rewarding.
You know, Coach, you coach on the offensive side of the ball, but you played on you coached in a Steelers era where the defense was so dominant. What's it like for an offensive coordinator, an offensive coach, or an offensive player to be able to lean on a defense like the defenses that those Steelers had?
Well, it's very rewarding, and it's a team game. And any time one side of the ball is dominant over the other, why, that side feels very comforting. And I know, take the Oakland Raiders. Well, they had a punter by the name of Ray Guy, as you recall. Well, he himself could control a game with field position. The defense knew that the offense was going to have a long ways to go when they got the ball, just because of a punter. So it encompasses everything, and each team has its strengths and weaknesses. And sometimes the defense has to help the offense till they get going. I think you saw that as evidence last year with the Kansas City Chiefs. You know, their defense at the beginning of the season was very good, and then the offense came along. So each side helps the other, and that's the fun of the game. That's why it's a team game.
You know, we last ones before we let you go. You know, when you were studying for the Senior Bowl tape with Chuck Knoll many, many years ago, he asked if you had watched the tape before you put the game plan together. And he said, how can you put it together if you don't look at the players' abilities? Talk about how you approached putting the game together with the talent that you had.
Well, you got to do what your players do. And I think that's one of the things with coaches, and it gets back to players. Can this player do what you're actually asking him to do, or is he good at what you're asking him to do? For instance, when I was at Pittsburgh, we were a trapping team and a double team kickout team. And I went to Minnesota, but then I went to the Detroit Lions, where Barry Sanders was, and we didn't run the trap there. I love the trapping game, but we didn't run the trap there because that was not Barry's thing. And Barry, to run a trapping game, you got to believe the hold is going to be there when you get there. Well, Barry just wanted you to give him the ball, and he'll find a hole, and he'll create the hole. So that's what you do. So I was there 3 years, and we never ran a trap. And then with Barry Sanders, I was talking to him one time, and it's in the book. He said, every game starts very fast. And the more I carry the ball, the slower the game goes. And so you had to give Barry the ball 25, 28 times to get him going. And you look at Barry's stats, sometimes he'd have 15 carries for 43 yards. Then he'd end up with 25 carries for 178 yards. And that was true of Barry. So that's the thing. If you got into a substitution thing with Barry, well, you're not taking advantage of what he does.
There are a million more anecdotes like that in the book. The book, again, is The Player's Coach, from Bradshaw to Manning to Brady and Beyond. Coach Tom Moore, thank you so much for giving us some time to talk. Best of luck with the book and the season.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
Our honor. Thank you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
We talk about this issue basically every week on the show. So let's get somebody who knows something about it. We're joined by 6-time New York Times bestselling author Armin Katayan to talk about his new book with John Talty called The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. Armin, congratulations so much on the book.
Thank you very much. It was a labor of love in a lot of ways. I mean, both John and I really, you know, have a great affection for college football and college sports in general. And it was like hopping on a speeding train, a freight train that didn't really have any idea where it was going half the time. And I think, honestly, still doesn't know where it's going. But we're really proud of the work. I think, you know, college football fans, certainly people that are in the coaching profession, it really is a pretty deep dive into what the state of the game is right now. And it's called The Price for a reason, because it's not just all the financial implications that are going on, the billions of dollars that are pouring in, but it's what we found to be even more humanizing and more powerful is it's the emotional price, the psychological toll, the physical toll that's being taken on people that really love this game and are devoting their lives to it, and frankly don't know from one day to the next, you know, what they're going to be facing.
You kind of built the plane while flying it as the sand shifted under your feet writing this book. And you said that you've never seen the amount of frustration, exhaustion, anger, and confusion that's going on right now. Talk about that from, you know, you talk to coaches and administrators. What is the feeling that they have? Because we often hear the player side, and you're told by the administrator or coach, well, that's what you get paid for. Just do your job. Talk about what's going on.
Yeah, I think that's the sort of the trite phrase here. You know, you're making a lot of money, so, you know, shut up and just do your job. But I think when you really see, like, Jed Fish, Arizona is a big part. They're raising Arizona, the first chapter is called, and what Jed did there in 3 years is remarkable, taking a team that Link had lost 12 straight games and lost their last game before Jed was hired 70-7 to Arizona State in a rivalry game. So he was coming in at the basement, the ground floor. But he said in his first year, he barely saw his wife, Amber, and his children. And he goes, I had to reset in the second year and just to see Amber in the morning, like from 5:30 to 6:30 in the morning before he went to the office and have a cup of coffee with her. So he could just kind of feel like he was part of the family. And you hear that story time and time again. And I think, look, we all know NIL has just thrown the sport into chaos. And that's understandable because it's long overdue that the athletes are sharing in the revenue now, that they're so pivotally important in creating. But I think the portal is really what's just thrown a complete wrench into the whole structure of college sports and college football in particular, because, you know, as you guys well know, now they're trying to close that spring portal. But you can't even set your roster. You know, you can come out of spring practice and you think you've got, you know, a second string cornerback, a backup who's really going to be good in a year or two. And right after that spring practice is over, he walks in your office and says, hey, coach, I think I'm going into the portal, because he's already been contacted by certain schools that figure, oh, well, we can induce him to come to our program, whether it's an ACC school into the Big Ten or a MAC school into the SEC or American Athletic Conference, really up and coming player to go into the SEC or Big Ten. So that kind of chaos, that kind of uncertainty is just so draining. And even the compliance people that we talk to, you know, when the pandemic hit, the first places that got cut in the athletic departments were the compliance people, because they're not really generating any revenue for the school. They're just keeping them on the right track. Some of the SEC programs have, I don't know, 6 or 7 compliance people, big departments. But if you're in a MAC school, you might have 1 or 2 compliance people, and you lose one, but you're still facing all the same issues, a lesser degree, but the same issues that an SEC or a Big Ten or Big 12 schools facing. So it's just flat out exhausting. And what we tried to do, and I think we were very successful at it, is not only tell great stories, but personalize that the whole issue of the price.
You know, there's so many, just in the paragraph that you just said, there's so many different things that are causing chaos within college football, from the portal and NIL being the two biggest ones. We had Ward Manuel on the show when the portal was just becoming a thing, and he expressed his concerns about it. But even his concerns back then pale in comparison to the number of doors that have been opened by the portal, including these compliance problems. What was your biggest takeaway from the athletic directors of what the biggest problems are with the portal, but besides compliance?
It's interesting, you know, Jeff, because the old school athletic directors were really the ones, and I would put Ward in the old school category. They were the ones that had to kind of keep the three-ring circus together. They weren't just responsible to the head football coach. They had 25 or 30 other sports that they were dealing with. Now, and those people had a history with the league and the commissioners, whether it was Jim Delaney or Swofford, or you can go back to Mike Slive and people like that in the SEC. They had a real understanding of how things work. Now, what you have a new generation of athletic directors that really are businessmen, and they're trying to keep this revenue train on track. And they're really not, they don't have the experience, and they don't really have the depth of knowledge to deal with this brave new world. And a lot of the old school athletic directors, it's just not worth it for them anymore. They can go and consult, or they can go do something else at a certain stage of their life. And you get these younger athletic directors who are really business minded, and they're really not equipped at the moment to handle all this chaos. You add in the collectives, you add in NIL, you add in lawsuits, you add in realignment, you add in you don't know from 1 month to the next whether you're going to be in the same conference maybe this year and going into next year. It's overwhelming. And I think what we try to do, Jeff, what we really tried to do, John and I, was personalize that. Whether it's, you know, John wrote some great chapters on Nick and on Kirby and on Jimbo Fisher and Jimmy Sexton, the most powerful, called the Power Broker, you guys know, far and away the most powerful sports agent in college. And I was really focused on the NCAA and Michigan, Arizona. There's a bunch of great chapters on that. And then you also have, you know, chapters on the collective, and you have the summit that was in DC where all these stakeholders get together trying to find solutions. But when you walk away, when you're depending on Congress, particularly this Congress, not exactly the bastion of bipartisanship, to say the least, to solve some of your problems, that tells you how big your problems are and how problematic things are going to be for you.
You mentioned the realignment portion of this, and that plays into the TV deal portion of everything. You write about the destruction of the Pac-12. Are we kind of on the verge of that with other conferences? You see Florida State and Clemson flirting with leaving the ACC, Connecticut flirting with leaving, where their TV deal is tied to Connecticut being in the conference. Where are we going with this all next?
I think one of the most interesting chapters in the book, I loved working on it, and John and I collaborated on that pretty good, is really the destruction of a 108-year-old Conference of Champions in a matter of 48 to 72 hours, and really based on two things: wanton greed and complete self-interest. SC was the dam that broke for the conference. When SC decided to join the Big Ten, and you have, you know, no reason in the God's green earth, really, for a school on the West Coast to want to be part of a Midwest conference other than Fox television money, the grant of rights money, which is so powerful now that in many ways, I think that the networks taking advantage of their relationships with the leagues are really driving realignment. There's no question. And once SC, that first domino fell, they took UCLA with them, obviously, because of the market in LA. And that's when Washington and Oregon started to circle around the Big Ten, and rightly so. Kevin Warren, and particularly Fox convincing Kevin Warren, the then commissioner of the Big Ten, to make an offer. And both Washington and first Washington and then Oregon accepting $30 million each in order to make the jump to the Big Ten. Well, that's all about the money. I talked to one ESPN executive who said, when they say it's not about the money, it's totally about the money. And that's exactly what it was. And Bobby Robbins, the president of Arizona, who I call in my own head, and he's like the solutionist. He was always trying to find a reason to keep that conference together. And he did everything he possibly could. But then he hears Carol Folt, who's the president of SC, saying, well, there's no way we would take any PAC or any Big 12 schools, because those aren't the schools that really could measure up to what a Pac-12 school is. But meanwhile, she's talking behind Bobby's back and the rest of the other people in the conference's back with the Big Ten. So on one side of her mouth, she's saying one thing, and on the other side of her mouth, she's saying something else. And she's the first one to jump. And when she jumped, as I said, it was Katie barred the door at that time. And yeah, I worry right now. I mean, there's already talk. You guys know this. Will it be the Power Two? Will it be the Big Ten and the SEC that break away, create their own set of rules, create their own division, the Power Two? I worry about if that happens, you know, the Michigans and the Ohio States and the Tennessees and we can talk about the Blue Bloods. They're all going to be fine. I worry about what happens to the Central Michigans. I went to San Diego State. San Diego State is one of those that's, you know, really treading water right now in terms of a conference and an affiliation. They make, you know, a pittance in media rights, grant of rights money. I don't know what's going to happen to those conferences. I think what you're going to find if things go the wrong way, if self-interest is still the driving force and money is the driving force, you're going to see, I think you could see a destruction of some of those smaller conferences for sure.
Armin, one of the takeaways I got from the book is how complicated all this is. It's not just the leagues. It's not just the schools. It's government. It's politics, it's money, even though they say it's not the money. You know, in one of your chapters, I found fascinating was the summit. And there's a quote from the person that you just mentioned, the University of Arizona's Robert Robbins, that he was a surgeon, and he said his main line of thinking is always never panic.
Yeah.
From everything that you learned, is it time to panic? And well, are people like that him now saying, you know what, it's time to panic?
Yeah, no, he, when I saw him again, you know, he had this other great line, we're in the ICU, you know, we're in the intensive care unit. And that's what he said in June of 23. He said it to me the night before. We had an interview at a hotel bar, the Willard Hotel, a classic bar in DC. And first time I had met Bobby, and I just was so impressed with him. And it's unfortunate he's leaving now the University of Arizona because he's just sick and tired of dealing with the faculty and all the stuff that he's got to deal with there. And that's unfortunate. But I think when I saw him in September of 2023, he goes, we're even worse. I mean, you know, we got the paddles on right now. So I think it is time to panic. I like what Charlie Baker is doing. I think he's a pragmatist. He's a political pragmatist. He's not married to any one major idea or direction. He has a framework that he wants, but he's willing to work within that framework. The question is, will the Greg Sankeys of the world and will the Tony Petitis of the world, you know, obviously the SEC commissioner and the Big Ten commissioner, will they put the conference's self-interest aside in order to work together for a greater good? By that, I mean, you know, sort of some sort of national NIL policy where everybody has some kind of transparency. And will there be some certification of the agents that are now operating really in kind of in the wild, wild west? I mean, I could be an NIL agent at this point. You guys could be NIL agents at this point in time. There's no credibility and there's no sanctioning of those kinds of people. So unless one of two things is going to happen, there's either going to be kind of an Oppenheimer kind of an event, an atomic bomb that's going to go off, and that will, the collateral damage will be so big, people will go, oh my God, we can't have this happen again. We have to come together and find a solution. Or
it hasn't gone off yet.
Well, it went off. The first fuse was lit at A&M. You know, when NIL started, and Jimbo and those boys down there in College Station, somebody said to me, and the person who knows what he's talking about at an agency in LA who deals with this stuff all day long, he goes, when A&M got involved, they had the booster network, they had the athletic director, they had the president, they had the facilities, they had the wherewithal and the will to win a national championship. And when that hit, everybody else around the room, all the other big boys said, well, holy shit, look what A&M's doing. So, okay, we're all in, whether it was Division Street with Oregon or whether it was what was going on at Tennessee or John Ruiz down in Miami, you can name a half a dozen of them. They're like, okay, baby, there's no rules. We can do whatever the hell we want, game on. And that was the beginning of it. But you saw what happened at A&M. Jimbo lost his job, but the culture there was so infected with the recruits coming in, bragging about the money they were getting and competing against guys who were already starters who weren't making chopped liver at that point in time. And that just destroyed the chemistry and the culture of the team. And that's another thing these coaches have to deal with. But I think that, I think the first bomb went off in College Station with Texas A&M. And now you look, just their neighbor over to the, where are they? Over to the north is, you've got Texas with Sarkisian, and those boys have pretty big wallets too. And you saw those Lamborghinis lined up. those Lamborghinis lined up outside the athletic department. If that's not a show of force, I don't know what is.
You mean Harbaugh wasn't going to line up Lamborghinis at Michigan? I mean, I got a Michigan man as a co-host here.
I think Michigan have problems. I think Michigan's collective is really, there's too many collectives at Michigan. You got five collectives. You got Champion Circle. And then you have Valiant. You have Stadium in Maine. You've got other ones, Hail Impact. You can't have five collectives. Even with Michigan's power and the prestige and the brand, you're really swimming upstream because you don't have, everybody has their own self-interest. Champion Circle, yes, has the imprimatur of the athletic department, but am I a donor? Well, why should I give to Stadium in Maine? Why should I give to Champion Circle? And I think Ward, the athletic director, Ward Manuel, was really slow. We report that in the book, words like methodical to use to describe Warren's approach. Others would use the word obstructionist to describe his approach. And his strained relationship with Jim Harbaugh adding to the equation. So I really like what they did with Sharon Moore. I think that team last year was a band of brothers that deserved, in every sense of the word, winning a national championship because they stayed together and they fought together and they worked out together to achieve a national champion. But I look down the line, and if you don't have a collective that's aligned with your athletic department and you're in lockstep in one kind of beating heart, you're going to be at a disadvantage, even though you have everything else that Michigan has to offer. You know, the NIL, that brand is one thing, but you still have to have collective money just to keep things even with some of the really power players.
Well, if people want to try and make chaos of what's going on in college football right now, you need to get this book, The Price, What It Takes to Win in College Football's Era of Chaos. Armagatayan, thank you so much for the time.
Hey, guys.
We'll talk to you sometime.
My pleasure. In the future. Thanks, Jason. Thanks, Jeff. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Thanks so much for joining us this week. Make sure to join us next Friday night to help you start your weekend in style. Have a great one, and we'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.